Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I am, recording in a bathroom this week, but bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, legendary guitarist from the band The Circle Jerks, from Red Cross, and from Bad Religion, Greg Hetston is on the show. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with the podcast, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast.com. That's run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and you will get the message to me. You can also find me on social media at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, head over to turnedoutapunk.com and pick up a t-shirt. Thank you to everyone that does do that. And tell your friends about it. I play in a band. We're called Fucked Up. We're currently on tour, hence why I'm recording in a bathroom. You can find out more details about the band and records we have coming up and upcoming tours. We're going to Europe and the Southwest coming up in a few weeks over at fuckedup.cc. And I think that's it, right? I don't have anything else to talk about, plug off the top. No. On to today's show. And as I said off the top, a legend on the show today, Greg Hetston. Greg is someone who, if you're a fan of this music, you probably heard play before, because he's been in not one, not two, but three of arguably the most important bands to come out of Southern California. And someone I've always wanted to kind of have a sit-down talk with. I've met Greg. I've been on tour with Greg, actually. We were on a festival tour together, but never really had the chance to punish him like this. So it's a huge thrill for me. Greg is currently playing back in the Circle Jerks. You can find out more information about this incredible tour they've been on. I was going to say Google it, but definitely don't Google Circle Jerks because you get a lot of weird things showing up. But you can find out more information about these upcoming tours at circlejerks.net. And the tour looks incredible so far. They've been on tour with, you know, a who's who of American punk bands. They're going over to Europe, playing with some incredible bands over there. So check it out. And one of my favorite bands of all time. I don't really have too much to ramble on about right now. I think that's about it. Pick up the Circle Jerks reissues, of course, on Trust Records. Once again, apologies for the audio for this intro. As I said, I'm still on tour and trying to keep my voice down and record in a bathroom. So that's why it sounds a little bit weird today. But that's that. Oh, and once again, I'm also sorry, because last week I teased that there was going to be a Turned Out a Punk from the vaults in between the Red Cross episode and this episode. But, you know, tour happens and it did not get put up in time. But I'm going to put that up after this episode. So don't worry. I'm not disappearing it from the schedule. But that's that. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Greg Hetston on Turned Out a Punk. Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I didn't tell you this off air, but I don't think I'd be doing what I'm doing without the Circle Jerks. Like, the Circle Jerks are my Beatles, my Rolling Stones, my real, like, that was the band that clicked for me in a big way. So thank you for that.
I appreciate that, because those are pretty giant names you just threw out there.
Well, you know, like, none of them ring as large in my life. I told Xander, so at the risk of repeating it, my stepfather famously, when I was going to go try and see your first reunion show in Toronto, told me that I was not allowed to go and see some Come In Your Face band. And that really sealed it for me. I had to go to the show. And unfortunately, you guys didn't make it because you broke up the day before. But you know what? That was fine, because it set me on a path.
All right.
But this is not about me. This is about you. And we got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Greg, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
I think one of my friend's older brother had a Ramones album. I mean, I kind of heard of it, but didn't quite know what it was, except for maybe in the fashion sense, and that it was something new, you know, coming out of New York. And then the whole English thing happened after that. But I heard a Ramones record, and there was just something about it that was that aggressive, hard, in-your-face, guitar-oriented rock that I was always looking for something more extreme at the time, and that seemed to be it.
How much awareness did you have of kind of like the local proto-punk stuff that was happening around the same time? Because you got like, you know, Zolar X and The Quick, The Runaways even. Like, you've got a lot of the sort of precursors there that weren't like quite as, you know, I guess, capital P punk yet.
Right. I knew of The Runaways, but didn't know anything about Zolar X or The Quick until I got into the punk scene. And by that time, the bands had broken up. So we were on their last legs.
Mm-hmm.
Never got to see either one of those, but yeah, I had no clue.
So where'd you kind of go from hearing the Ramones record for the first time? Like, what was your kind of like next steps? Because you're, once again, you're obviously super young getting into all this stuff. And it's at the very beginning of it.
Yeah, I think was seeing a clip of, I mean, heard about the Sex Pistols and all the other ruckus that was going on in England about them and God Save the Queen and all that stuff during the Queen's, was it Jubilee or?
Yeah, the Silver Jubilee, I guess.
Jubilee, I guess, yeah. One of the Jubilees. And thought that was cool. Then I saw this TV show. It was, who was it? I always forget if it was Leon Russell or Leon Redbone, because they're both Leons. I think it was Leon Redbone had this, like, I'm going to look it up on my...
I think, is it Leon? Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm thinking of the clip. There's like a famous video clip of this thing, right?
Of the Clash playing on a being filmed at some gig in England. And it was great. The crowd was like pogoing and people were spitting on them. I'm like, what the hell is this? This is great. I mean, I might've heard the Clash, but seeing that clip, like maybe really like, okay, I got to look into what the hell's going on with this punk rock thing.
It was amazing how it seems like it kind of just hit. Like, it just kind of, like you're saying, they're, you know, they're the Ramones or sort of this general awareness, but then it seems like the media just took hold of this thing, and it was, you know, it was on TV. People were talking about the Sex Pistols, I guess, were ripe for media exploitation.
See, no, I'm not. Yeah. I'm just, it might've been Leon Russell. I don't know. Anyway, whatever. It was on one of those. The clip's out there somewhere. I found it at one point because I was like, that Leon Russell, Leon Redbone, it was a really great clip. And I remember hearing they were going to be on there, and I taped the audio off my TV. I put like the headphone jack into my little cassette recorder.
Yeah.
I wanted to capture the live soundtrack of that going down. And I thought it was great. And then, you know, and I started getting hip to like the Buzzcocks and, you know, Sham 69 and this and that.
Go on.
On the English side. And then I kind of found out, by listening to the radio, that there is actually an LA punk scene, and heard the Dickies on the radio. And that was my first punk rock show, was the Dickies in Middle Class. After hearing the Dickies on K-Rock.
So were you listening to Rodney on the Rock? Was that kind of like the exposure, or was it just generally getting played on K-Rock at that time?
It was generally getting played, but I was listening to Rodney, and there was also a couple of like specialty shows. It was more freeform. It wasn't much. It was less formatted than the other rock radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you would hear David Bowie, and then you would hear the Sex Pistols, or, you know, this or that, or something more, you know, Roxy music and stuff like that, more, or, you know, Lou Reed, that kind of thing. But it wasn't really getting played on the mainstream radio too much or at all.
So prior to that Dickies Middle Class show, had you been to any other concerts?
Yeah, I just been to the big, you know, the big rock shows, you know, big arena shows, and some smaller shows that were, you know, of, and I saw like Ronnie Montrose do it was like jazz rock exploration thing, you know, thing at a club. And then, you know, it was funny, a few years later, I was playing the same club. But it was mostly like arena stuff, you know. But I'd never been to like a club show until I saw the Dickies. Not that I can remember. No, that was pretty much my first Hollywood show at the Whiskey. Yep.
So how did that kind of compare, obviously being shockingly different, I can imagine, but like, what were some of your memories of that Dickie show versus these other shows you had been to?
People were a little more friendly. It's like, for some reason, besides, you know, being at the big arena show, someone wanted to hand you a joint or something. But it just seemed like more of a community. And then when I saw the first band go on, the Middle Class, they were like people my age, like playing really fast. I'm like, oh man, these kids can do it. I can do it, you know?
Yeah.
Made me feel more confident in getting out there and trying to be in a band.
Was that before or after Out of Vogue had come out?
Pardon?
Was that before or after Out of Vogue? Like before did they have records out of that point?
Yeah, probably Out of Vogue was out.
Okay.
I don't know if I had it yet, but probably got it shortly after.
They must have been incredible at that stage. Because like that record, obviously, still rates as one of the greats.
Right. And I do remember seeing the Sid doing My Way video that they showed. And I remember there was a couple and they were, you know, it kind of frightened me. But, you know, they had their noses pierced and they had a safety pins connecting to each other. And that kind of freaked me out, but nobody gave me shit because I still had long hair. I still had hair, and it was longer, and it was pretty cool.
Well, like, yeah, it's funny how it seems like it's a couple years later that things start getting really violent from what I've kind of taken from people. Like, it seems like that first wave was very different and very sort of accepting and welcoming of all types of people.
It was. It was just the safe haven for all the misfits, you know.
Not
the band, but, you know, or anybody that was a little different, even if they didn't look different.
When did you meet Jeff and Steve McDonald?
I met Jeff it was my senior year and I was taking Photoshop in high school. And he came to class, one of the first classes of that semester or whatever. And he had a folder, a peachy folder with a flyer on it, like the Bags and somebody else. And I'm like, oh, you like punk rock? And he kind of gave me that look like, oh, is this kid going to give me shit too? And I was like, I like it too. He's like, really? And then, you know, we were allowed to bring records and play it while we were developing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would rotate between the different classmates, bring records, and whoever was partnering up doing the lab stuff. You know, so instead of having to listen to Saturday Night Fever and Grease, we would be able to put on some punk rock while we were in the dark room. And then he said, oh, you know, I play guitar. And I play guitar too. And my brother's a bass player. We're thinking about starting a band. And that's kind of how Red Cross got started.
And were there a lot of kids? Because you mentioned he was like kind of worried that you were going to give him shit for being into punk rock. Were there a lot of you getting into punk rock at that time? Or is it still like a little tiny cult?
Very tiny amount of people. I mean, there was nobody really dressing too punk at that point in my high school, but there were people that were aware and liked it, but most people, you know, poo-pooed it.
Yeah. So how long after that first show did you meet these guys? And I guess you formed the Tourists before you call it Red Cross, right?
Yeah. Before I met who?
How long after that first show, sorry, was this meeting with Steve?
Oh, that was probably early 1979, I'd imagine. It would have been like, you know, the Dickies was in the summer of 78, and I know Red Cross formed in 79. So 6 months maybe after that.
It's kind of funny because you guys are the first punk rock kids, right? Like there's like adults that are in the scene and there's obviously like a generation that kind of just directly precedes you, but you are the first wave of kids that are getting into this thing in this way that so many kids kind of get into this thing where, you know, it's just the excitement is just there and you're like a young person discovering this world. And it's really sort of the archetype, like how heavily you guys were into music, you know, playing these bands. And like you were saying, like you're playing these venues that you had seen these sort of established rock acts a few months later. Like it really is a scene where young people, you know, could kind of take over, or young people did have equal footing as adults.
Yeah, no, for sure. There were very many, you know, there was only a handful of younger kids into the scene back when I started going, back in my day, Sonny, when I first started going to shows, you know.
Yeah.
Most parents maybe wouldn't let their kids out. I mean, it was the late 70s. It was a little more like, yeah, whatever. But there still wasn't a whole lot of really young kids.
Well, yeah, because like Steve talked about it when he was on the show. Like he got kidnapped eventually. Like he got kidnapped by his girlfriend.
I remember that. Yeah.
Well, that must have been really kind of terrifying. Like to be a young person to have something like that kind of go down around you.
Yes, and I just remember his parents were like, you know, freaked out, and you know, and by that time I was already out of the band, but you know, I was still friends with him and in contact with his parents, and it was pretty shocking. Yeah.
Well, I guess it's a scene like also the a woman who went to shows with the mask was killed by the Hillside Strangler, I believe too. Right. Like it seems like it is a scene that's kind of like this like fantasy land for young people, but the reality is it's kind of happening in the real world, and it's happening in a big major city like Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, in Hollywood at that time was, you know, I mean, it's all gentrified now. There's pockets of sketchiness, but it was pretty sketchy. I mean, there was prostitutes lining up down Sunset Boulevard and parts of Hollywood Boulevard for miles and miles. And, you know, it was run down, a lot of closed businesses. It was, you know, there was people squatting in buildings on Hollywood Boulevard that are now like huge mega monstrosity. What's it called? Like, you know, what do you call it? You know, where there's movie theaters and shopping centers. And
yeah, developments, giant.
Giant development, Hollywood and Vine, like a block from that. Whereas this other development, there was, you know, there was a rundown abandoned building that all the punks were squatting in. So it was sketchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it feels like, you know, like it's almost like a precursor for something like this to happen is you need kind of a rundown city space with lots of spaces for bands to practice and people to live cheaply. Right. Like it's almost like this is necessitated by urban decay a little bit.
Yes. And then, the established clubs, aside from maybe the Whiskey and Starwood for the bigger bands, you'd have to have like, you know, the smaller underground clubs. Which the mask was literally underground, the basement of a porno theater, Pussycat Theater, and just, you know, people running out halls and throwing shows, and you know, there was no permits, and you know, you never knew when the cops were going to come break it up.
Do you remember your first time going to the mask?
Yes, I do. I'd already been going to some shows, and it had closed for a bit, and then reopened for a little bit. So, yeah, so I actually have some photos. I wish I could find the rest of them. I found a couple of them of the Go-Go's playing at the Mask.
Oh, awesome.
I can't remember who they played with. It might have been X, but I do have some photos of the Go-Go's at the Mask.
It's wild when you go back and you kind of look at, you know, you mentioned the Go-Go's, you mentioned X, obviously yourselves. And, you know, and I say yourselves, I mean, like all the bands you've been involved in. It's incredible when you think about how small that room is. Like I broke into that building and went downstairs and got to see like the Mask, and you're like, wow, it's like something so small produced so much culture. Like it changed rock and roll history in that little room. And like, obviously lots of culture comes out of Los Angeles, but it's hard to think of like something that concentrated happening before or after.
Yeah. Cause it was the only place like it at the time.
Yeah.
So that was it. Like all the great bands that came out of CBGB's, because that's the only place that those bands could play.
Do you remember the first time you went to, you met The Last?
Yeah, I believe it was at the church where Black Flag practiced and Red Cross practiced and Descendants. And that's where I met those guys. They're there.
They seem like a band that's kind of understated in their influence.
Yeah, they were one of the most popular club bands, and they had more of a diverse crowd because they were kind of like 60s revival garage, but they had some punk attitude and, you know, Beatlesque harmonies at times. And they were, you know, they were pioneers in, you know, putting out singles of a local band that wasn't mainstream. So they were definitely up there with some of my biggest influences, and always enjoyed them.
It feels like the stuff that was happening in the church was like a very kind of like separate thing. Like it was almost like a thing unto itself a little bit. Did you kind of get that sense? Like this was a, you know, I don't want to say a cult because that kind of overstates it, but like that this was like very much like a scene within a scene kind of going on.
Yeah, because it was in the suburbs, you know, it was in, you know, a block from the beach, mm-hmm. or two blocks maybe. And it was, yeah, just kind of some kind, you know, happens organically.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Black Flag would throw parties, and eventually the people from Hollywood were coming to the parties. And then the people from Orange County, and that kind of like, you know, that helped spawn all the other bands and the introduction to the Orange County bands and the South Bay bands to the Hollywood scene. And it all kind of exploded from there. But I think that was definitely the powder keg of the explosion of LA punk from just a Hollywood thing.
Could you feel it changing? Like, was there like a sense in the air? Like obviously the Circle Jerks are forming around this point, but there is that sort of fabled shift that happens when the kids from Orange County and down south kind of come up to Hollywood and start going to the shows. Like could you see that going down in front of your eyes, or do you think that's overstated by people historically?
No, it's not overstated. It was definitely a big thing because it, you know, they brought that crazy skateboarder, surfboarder mentality. It's like, let's just go for it, fuck it, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, some of them were more athletic than the artistic types, and they were a little more aggressive. And, you know, some of them had that jock attitude, wanted to beat up hippies, you know, people with long, you know, instead of people come up and give you shit, and then if they try to fight you, you'd run away. They'd want to fight. They brought like, fuck you, bring it on mentality. We're not going to take your shit. It was pretty passive, you know. You know, there was, you know, there were fights here and there, but it almost became like that's when it really became, okay, it's going to be us against them, and we're going to resort to violence if necessary.
Well, it's so interesting because, like, it's, you know, I've heard people come on, and there's been all sorts of different perspectives over the years on people who've been on the show on the effects of that or what it was like at different times. But like you're saying, like, the end result was punks were not going to take shit anymore. And
yeah,
even from other punks, unfortunately, but like certainly from people around them.
Right.
Did you kind of, you know, because the Circle Jerks are a band that, you know, it feels like kind of gets it. Well, like, you know what, like you and Black Flag are like the, you know, the big bands that bring in hardcore and this sort of energy. Did you see this happening around the country as you're playing different shows too? Like, did you see these shows kind of having younger kids beginning to show up and like a change in the scene? Because it is the birth of hardcore at that point.
Yes, for sure. I mean, you know, with bands like that, it definitely brought a younger thing. And then, you know, some of the other bands that were from Orange County that were younger, like the Adolescents, Agent Orange.
Yeah.
TSOL. And then they, you know, and it definitely brought in a younger, you know, a younger group of bands into the punk rock world.
What was the deal with Greg? Because you have that one song that comes out years later on the soundtrack to the movie, but it was, it's kind of like a more proggy thing, right?
It was kind of proggy, folky. I don't know. It was a... just something bored between tours to do, just getting together with friends and making noise, you know?
Yeah.
And Greg was always into like other styles and folk and, you know, the bluegrass or whatever, Americana stuff. And it was a way for him to get an outlet of some of that. And I just kind of coattailed it.
Because there's definitely like a point where it seems like a lot of bands, you know, like, well, Bad Religion does Into the Unknown, you know, but there's a lot of bands that go metal, or a lot of bands go more country. Like a lot of bands kind of leave the scene, it feels like, or driven away from the scene for whatever reason. But the Circle Jerks are kind of the one band that kind of holds true throughout that time. Did you feel like there was a moment where everyone started kind of changing or shifting? And was there like ever a temptation for you to kind of like explore that side? Or do you always want to stay in like punk hardcore bands?
We wanted to stay hard. I mean, we kind of slowed down a bit. We went a little more quote unquote rock, but I never would say we didn't go the speed metal route because, you know, I'm not a shredder. And, yeah, then we saw some of the bands, you know, get their hair all poofy and go a little towards the glam when that and all that started happening. It just wasn't our thing.
Yeah. When it's kind of like it is the band that kind of holds it together, it seems. And then I guess Bad Religion is another band that's brought up, like once Back to the Known kind of happens as being like the band that kind of
right
carries that flag for LA during the lean years.
Mm-hmm. There were some lean years.
What are your memories of the Back to the Known show, like the first show in San Diego? I think it's in San Diego, right? Or there's a famous video of it. Maybe it's Santa Monica. It's a huge show, and it was the first show back around Back to the Known EP.
Might have been the Olympic Auditorium.
Might have been the auditorium show.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was a lot of people were leery of like what Bad Religion was going to sound like since after the Into the Unknown debacle pretty much drove all the punkers away. And people didn't know what to expect. And I think they were like a little happy when we came out and did the old stuff.
It's such a great video. Like there is like a real intensity to the performance. And I guess that's kind of where it comes from.
Right. I'm sure might've been some drugs and alcohol involved too. And some of us, not Greg, he never really partied.
But yeah, that might have also added to the edge a little bit.
And that venue, I think, believe it was Olympic. That venue was just had a lot of energy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about. Like, what are your thoughts? What were your thoughts when you went to these other places and you started seeing kind of like this West Coast version of hardcore exported? Because it's really that brand of hardcore that becomes the dominant brand of hardcore, you know, on the East Coast, you know, like when you're going into places like Boston or DC.
Right. Yeah. It was kind of like, oh, wow. These people are listening to our stuff. You could hear the influence. It was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's amazing how big that influence is, right? Like it's certainly like, it really is the foundation of what becomes like sort of the dominant strain of underground music in America.
Right.
How'd you guys get around tours back then? Like, was it through calling cards? Like booking tours and stuff back then?
Yeah, there was that. And then there was this magazine you would get. It was called Overthrow.
Okay.
And it was published out in New York, like in Hell's Kitchen area, kind of near CB's. And it was like anti-establishment, anti-government. It was kind of hippie-esque. And they would publish calling card numbers from all these major corporations, and they get, you know, eventually the companies would get a hold of it, catch wind on where these numbers were coming from, and they change them. But they also had, you know, someone cracked the code on how they actually came up with the four digit, like you're kind of like a PIN number, but you know, your phone number, then another four numbers.
Yeah.
And if you knew the last four digits of the phone number, there was a formula on how they came up with the calling card. So you could just look up a phone of a business and make your own fake calling card number. And they weren't they weren't hip to the fact that someone cracked the code on how they did fake credit card numbers from like Exxon or, you know, Bank of America, or even the phone companies. Some of them were they figured out what the corporate calling card number was for, like, you know, AT&T or something. It was great.
Well, it's so awesome because, like, this is this brief period where, like, you know, online, I guess, surveillance hadn't gone to the point. Like, you know, you can't imagine this sort of scam would operate, or like a magazine like Overthrow would exist for very long in the present day.
There, unless it was on the dark web.
Yeah, that's true. There is probably an equivalent now that I'm just not hip enough to know about. There's like a young generation of punk kids that have already hacked this code, I guess. But it does feel, though, at this time, like photocopiers and cassette, you know, recorders, like there's all these things that were in the hands of young people to, like, you know, produce culture or to get their culture out there even.
Yeah. Well, if you were actually getting back to the calling card, if you just use a payphone and you were smart, you'd be hard to get busted for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh no. And that survived even when I was first starting touring, like there were still like calling card scams to kind of get around long distance charges.
Yeah.
Like it feels like it was a tradition that was kind of passed down much in the same way of like that fabled like tour book that DOA had that they gave to Black Flag, and then Black Flag kind of took around and everyone kind of, like, you know, it feels like this is sort of like this like oral history that gets passed down from one generation of bands to the next. What was the like you mentioned going to New York and you know, the Overthrow, when was your sort of political awareness, when did that begin for you, like, you know, being aware of all this sort of like stuff like Yippies and sort of countercultural stuff?
I guess from my parents. My dad was always watching the news and, you know, really into politics and taking me to political rallies as a young kid. So I was always kind of aware. And he was pretty left-leaning. So I was definitely aware of, you know, it was the Vietnam War era.
Yeah.
Nixon and, you know, the civil rights and the craziness and riots at Watts and Detroit and all those things. So I was definitely aware.
Were you aware of Manson when that all went, when, because obviously that's once again, a thing that's brought up time and time again, right? Kids that kind of were growing up in that area during that time.
Yes, definitely aware of Manson. But, you know, I was younger and I was definitely aware of the Watts riots, but it didn't compute. I was really young. But when you know, some of the other mass murderers, that famous ones that were going around LA, like the Hillside Strangler for sure, and what's that, Richard Ramirez,
the Night Stalker. Yeah it really feels, though, like the
also the SLA stuff. There was a sporting goods store that used to sell guns, and it got, you know, hit by the SLA, and they stole a bunch of weapons from it. And my neighbor, kind of in my neighbor a few blocks away. So it I was hip.
Yeah, no, it
was scary.
You know, like the fact, like, you guys are a product of a very turbulent time in American history. And like, sort of the kids of the generation that would have been post Charles Manson, like there was a chilling effect, it feels like, on youth culture in that part of America, all over America around that time. Yeah. And that punk is sort of the first big, you know, youth explosion kind of after that, you know, 10 years later.
Right. After the whole hippie thing was over. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The hippie experiment. And it feels like the police reaction, society's reaction in that part of America is very much, you know, almost conditioned or reflective of what had happened with the hippie thing, like how scared they were of youth culture.
It happened with punk. It happened with hip hop when that, you know, gangster rap, when that first became, when it first came out. So that's just what happens to the mainstream society. Doesn't know how to process this still.
It kind of, I guess you have to have that, right? Like if something's going to be important and relevant for young people, it has to scare.
Right. Scare the authorities.
Yeah, if they're into it, it's never going to stick with the kids.
That's right. Yeah.
Eventually, you know, the Circle Jerks wind up on LAX Records, And are you guys are managed by Steve Gold, right, for a time?
Steve Gold and Jerry Goldstein, yeah.
What was it like being managed by them? Did you ever get to meet Eric Burdon? Because he was also involved in LAX Records too, I believe.
He was already left their management. They really had, they might have had War, and that was about it. They had us, the Crusados for a minute, or the Plugs. I think it was the Plugs. They didn't have many bands left because they ripped everybody off.
Well, it feels like it would have been a hard time because, like, around you there would have been just, like, you know, the speed metal stuff would have been going on, and you know, maybe college radio stuff hadn't even really started happening yet. But it just feels like, yeah, like, where would you guys have fit? Maybe with War.
Yeah. No, it was weird. But it was like, okay, we'll give it, what the hell, we'll try if we can get some quote unquote real legitimate management. And it definitely took us to the next level, but they were also the management company that said we shouldn't do Repo Man because we weren't getting paid enough money. And we're like, are you kidding? Did you read the script? We get to make fun of ourselves, you know? And it's like, no, we're doing this thing. So.
Did you know that it was going to be a cult thing when you were doing it? Because Xander said he did. Xander said he could feel it right away just reading the script.
Yeah, he would say that. No, we thought it would be cool, but yeah. I don't know if we know if it would be a cult thing or what, but we knew it was great. And the people involved, like the other bands and the music, and it was going to be, you know, something we definitely didn't want to miss out on.
Yeah.
We must have had some kind of idea, but we didn't realize how big of a thing it would be.
Speaking of how big things were, like, how much of a change did you think Nirvana had on what you guys were doing at the time? Because, you know, I've heard Larry Livermore was on the show and saying that he thinks that Nirvana's influence or impact on Green Day and the stuff that they were doing is a little overstated because their thing was kind of already going by that point. Like, do you kind of feel the same way, or did you think that Nirvana's success opened doors for other bands?
It opened doors for, yeah, they pretty much single-handedly killed the whole grunge thing and hair metal. Like, that was it. It was over for the most part. And everybody, you know.
But you guys already had a following, right? Yeah. I don't know. I'm always like,
yeah, you know, but those bands also would say, hey, these are the bands we listen to, and this is what we like. This is our influences. Yeah. So it definitely helped make punk more acceptable when, you know, multi-platinum, you know, artists were saying, yeah, this is where we came from. We came from the punk rock thing.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's almost like that determinist versus, I don't know, individualist argument. Like, it's almost like, was this going to happen anyway? And would it have been another band if it wasn't Nirvana? Or did Nirvana, were they the catalyst? Because it feels like it's kind of going towards that way anyway. Like, you guys were having success on your own terms. And, you know, there were other bands and other places.
Metallica was another one.
Yeah. It
was definitely punk influenced.
Yeah, and they would rep it too.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, like, it's almost, I don't know, I've it's only after talking to Larry that I kind of really started thinking about it, but like, oh yeah, like Operation Ivy put out their record before Nirvana put out their record. Like, things were already in motion in these other scenes, and
sure, yeah, there was the whole Minneapolis thing before the whole Seattle thing.
Yeah,
you know, it was going to happen somewhere, like you said, some band would have taken it to the next level.
Yeah. What was it like, though, after that point where everything did change? Like, you know, and maybe even a little few years later for, you know, where all of a sudden punk is, you know, as big as it was in LA during the first wave. Like, it is kind of hitting that point again.
Right.
Like, is that something where, just having not lived through it, was that something that, you know, like, you were prepared for or seeing coming? Or is that something that just came out of nowhere for you? Or?
It was all gradual. So it kind of, you know, it wasn't like it was a gradual decline where, you know, the scene was huge and then it just went pretty much back underground. And the different styles became more popular, different scenes sprung up. And then it started, you know, growing a little bit. And then when the whole, you know, Nirvana, Green Day, Offspring thing, it just brought it all back up. to another level and made it safe for all of the world to say, I like punk rock.
Yeah, I guess it is that safe thing that happens, yeah. You know, like it really does kind of, it's not people safety pinning their noses together. I guess they were still, though. That I remember seeing people doing that. At that Circle Jerk show that you guys broke up the day before. Definitely people with their noses safety pinned together at that show.
Yeah.
Greg, this has been amazing. And anytime you want to come back on the show and chat about punk, please know the door is always open.
Well, thank you. I love the punk rock.
Thank you, Greg, for coming on the show. When you're right there, Greg will be back for a part two whenever he feels like it. He can come back whenever he wants. But until then, that is that. Coming up on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk Proper. This is one I'm very, very excited for you to hear. I thought it was going to go one way when I sat down to do this interview, and it went somewhere completely different. And my gosh, it might be one of my favorite episodes I've ever gotten to do. Coming up on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk, from Death Cab for Cutie, Ben Gibbard is on the show. And this is a good one. I'm very excited for you to hear it. And that will be coming out in a few short days. And there'll probably be a From the Vaults in between the two, too. But that is that. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous peoples matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different races and faiths and different nationalities, and make sure people keep their hands out of other people's uteruses and telling them what to do with their reproductive systems. This is not political stuff that I'm talking about here. I'm talking about just basic human rights stuff. People have the right and the need to live free. Free from hatred, free from violence, free from discrimination. So get involved. If there's organizations that are doing good work that you believe in, see if you can lend your time, lend your money, do what you can. Get out there. Do something. Speaking of doing something, maybe do something for yourself and try and meditate. I didn't believe in that shit. And it's not shit. It's not shit at all. I thought it was, but turns out I was a shithead. Because it really works. People have known this for thousands of years, but I'm telling you, try it. It's for yourself. You know, it might take a couple times before it clicks with you, but it's worth it. It really is. Speaking of doing stuff for other people, though, sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. They're literally just dead weight, and I've seen it. I've seen it do miracles. So sign those organ donor cards, please. And speaking of doing something for the scene, create your own culture. Get out there. Start a band. Start a fanzine. Do something. Anyone can do something in this thing. And that's what makes it so special. It's a scene where you can create part of it, and you're encouraged to create part of it. So, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be something so grandiose as a band or a zine. Maybe it's just a flyer. Do some flyer art for someone. Who knows? It'll make you feel better. And that is that for me. Thank you for listening. Next week I'll be in my home basement again, so it won't be as echoey. But that's that. Stay safe. Love you.